There we go. Hi, everybody. Dan Hirschberg. It's Danny Baseball time.
All right.
Play ball. Play ball. And I am very excited to have my good friend. Can I call you my good friend now?
You certainly may.
All right.
You could have before as well.
Okay. Well, my good friend, Peter Golenbach, one of the premier, if not the premier, baseball author in the country. He's written upwards of 70 books, not just baseball, some entertainment stuff. Has a tremendous reputation. The books are all great. He's had bestsellers up and down the New York Times list. He's interviewed Sparky Lyle, Craig Nettles, Billy Martin, and even Tony Curtis. So
it's true.
All good stuff. And I know he's got his notes. He wants to talk about the Rays, but let's talk about some of your books a little bit first.
Well, see, the books I can talk about without my notes. I'm not sure I can talk about the Rays without my notes.
Well, there you go.
That's the point. I mean, they take this team and they make the thing topsy-turvy such that when the spring comes, I don't know who the hell's playing for these guys.
There you go.
So that's why I need notes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the books first. So you've written a lot of books. You've had some bestsellers.
You know, I was a lawyer for 6 weeks.
For 6 weeks?
Yeah. Yeah, I went to Dartmouth College, and then I went to NYU Law School.
And
yeah.
What happened after
well,
6 weeks?
Yeah, I went to work for Friedman and Fishman in New York City, and he handed me a pile of files. And he said, look at these files and tell me what you got. So I spent about 6 weeks working on the files, and I walked into it and I'm saying, Mr. Friedman, I'm sorry to tell you, but the statute of limitations on 10 of these files had run. These were tort cases. These were 10-year statute of limitations. I mean, to tell you when a lawyer lets the statute of limitations run, that is not a good thing. So he said to me, Peter, I want you to call these people up and tell them why they don't have a case. And I said, Mr. Friedman, I quit. And so that was my 6 weeks practice of law. I then saw in the newspaper, and it's funny how the newspaper has had such a big role in my life. This is one example where I opened the paper in the New York Times and it said, wanted author lawyer. Author lawyer, it said. That's what they wanted. Author lawyer with a New Jersey telephone number.
You got it.
So I called them up and it was Prentice Hall. And they had a yearly, this was 1972, and they had a publication every month, President Nixon's Wage and Price Controls. Oh, yeah. And they wanted me to be the editor of the Wage and Price Controls for a whopping $7,500 a year. And I took the job. And I'm sitting there, and they're sending me the rules and regulations. And I'm discovering that any time a corporation wanted to raise its prices, the board let them do it. But any time the workers wanted to raise their salaries, they wouldn't let them do it. And I thought to myself, this was so Nixonian, you know. And so after about 6 weeks of this, the luck of my life, I found a trade book catalog of the books that they were publishing at Prentice Hall. One of them was a two by Lawrence Welk. Yeah. Another one was Where the Money Was by that bank robber who became so famous. And there were a couple of sports books as well. Well, when I was a kid, I had found a book called The New York Yankees by Frank Graham. And it was a wonderfully written book. It was about Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio and Bill Dickey and all these guys. And I was, I was born with the baseball gene. So I must have read this damn book six times. I mean, I was just enthralled by the stories he was telling in it. And that book was written in 1947. Well, I lived through a period where the Yankees, between the years of 1949 and 1964, 16 years, 14 pennants, 9 world championships. Now, the first that I remember was 1954. The first thing that I can ever remember was Willie Mays' fabulous catch in center field in 1954. But once 55 came around, I was able to you know, remember these things. And as a Yankee fan, I won a pennant in 55. I won a pennant in 56. I won a pennant in 57. I won a pennant in 58. The damn White Sox won one in 59. But then the Yankees won one in 60. They won one in 61. They won one in 62, 63, and 64. And I thought to myself, this would be the perfect time to write the sequel to Frank Graham's New York Yankees. So, just on a whim, I went down to the trade book division and knocked on the door of the chief editor. His name was Nick Dincheco. And this was such a small, you know, outfit that when I knocked on the door, he said, "Come in." You know, you go to Simon & Schuster, one of these other places, you got to go through, you know, three secretaries before you can talk to the guy in charge, but not Apprentice Hall. So he let me in. So I gave him this talk about how wouldn't it be wonderful during the 16 years, 14 pennants, each year the Yankees had at least 1 million fans. If we could sell, you know, 2% of those, you know, 16 million fans, we'd have a best-selling book. Guy gives me $2,500 for a contract to write this book. Okay. So I go to Yankee Stadium, and this was before Steinbrenner bought the team. He bought the team in January. I show up in September. So it was not the Steinbrenner Yankees. Wonderful man. I can't think of his name at the moment. It doesn't matter. No.
Burke?
Yes.
Burke.
Michael Burke.
Michael Burke.
Okay.
Michael Burke.
By the way, this is the toughest interview I've ever had. You know.
So Michael Burke, these lovely, lovely people, they invite me in to come do whatever research I want to do with the Yankees. So I spent 2-3 months going through. They had probably 100,000 newspaper articles that I could go through. So now I'm ready to sit down and write a book. And smartly, it occurs to me that you cannot write a book based on newspaper articles because there's nothing new. So I went back to Nick Dincheco and I said, "Look, I really must go interview all these Yankee players." And Marty Appel, who was the assistant PR guy, gave me the telephone numbers and addresses of all the Yankees alums. I mean, can you imagine what that does for a guy, especially a nobody, who wants to write a book? Holy smokes. So I go back to Dincheco and I said, "Look, I got to go interview all these players." He gives me another $2,500 and I go on the road and I start going all over the country interviewing all of these Yankee players from 1949 to 1964. The only one who wouldn't see me, I went out to San Francisco to talk to Joe DiMaggio, and clearly he had no interest in being interviewed because he was afraid that somebody would ask him about Marilyn Monroe and what happened, why were they divorced and all of that. But everybody else, I mean, I went to Dallas. Mickey Mantle said, "By all means, you know, come see me." So go to Dallas, get on the phone. I got the telephone numbers. So Merlin Mantle answers the phone. I said, "Hello, may I speak to Mickey, please?" And she says to me, "Mickey is in New York." I said, "Mickey is in New York? Okay." So the next day I got on the plane, fly to New York. I go into the clubhouse, the Yankee clubhouse, and I was such an incredible Mickey Mantle fan that I could not go up to him. So I went over to Ellie Howard, who I had interviewed. I said, "Ellie, do me a favor. Would you introduce me to Mickey, please?" He goes, "Sure." So he walks me over to Mickey, and I said, "You know, Mr. Mantle, would you be so kind to let me talk to you for a little while?" And Mickey looks me in the eye, and he goes, "No." And then he absolutely bursts out laughing. You know, this is Mickey's sense of humor. And he gave me probably the most amazing interview he's ever given anybody. And I have no idea why. But this is 1973. He retired in 1968. And he proceeds to tell me of his nightmares, where he's sleeping at night and he's dreaming that he's walking up to Yankee Stadium and he can't find the door. Mm-hmm. And so he breaks out into a cold sweat and he wakes up. I mean, I wanted to hug the guy. It was amazing. And part of it, he was telling me in the 1951 World Series, which is when he stepped on a drain pipe and really terribly hurt his leg. He said his father had come to watch him play in the World Series, but his father had cancer, and he didn't know it. And he said, this is how we found out. So Mickey puts his two hands on my right shoulder and pulls down, the same way he did to his father when he was getting out of the cab, and his father collapsed. Meanwhile, when Mickey pulled down on my arm, I thought I was being pulled down by, you know, a snowplow or something. I mean, this had to be the strongest guy in the whole wide world. It was amazing. But that's how we found out that his father was dying of cancer, and father ended up in the same hospital that he ended up at the time. So go back to Nick Dinchecko. I said, I've interviewed X, Y, and Z. He gives me another $2,500. Okay, so I go to Gainesville to see Roger Maris. And Roger Maris, clearly, he's avoiding me too for some reason. I don't know why. So I get in the car and I drive to Atlanta, where Cleet Boyer has his restaurant, this wonderful restaurant of his. And Cleet says to me, I'll meet you in the restaurant that was called the Golden Glove, by the way. That was the name of the restaurant. So he said, I'll meet you at the restaurant at 9 a.m. Okay, fine. So I get into the restaurant. I'm sitting at the bar at 9 a.m. drinking coffee while all these former high school football players are sitting there drinking beer at 9 o'clock in the morning. Holy mackerel. Anyhow, I sat there from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 12 hours, when Cleet Boyer shows up with his best friend, Roger Maris. So Cleet brings Roger over to me, and Roger and I sit down at a table, and we're looking at each other. And I say, hi, Rog, how you doing? He goes, oh, fine, fine. Now, I'm afraid to say to Roger, can I interview you? Because if he said no, it would kill the evening. So we're just sort of staring at each other when Roger says to me, do you want to go outside and talk? I'm thinking to myself, yeah, that's exactly what I would like to do. So we go out, and I sit down on the hood of a car with my tape recorder, and Roger tells me about his life for about an hour and a half. And he was absolutely sensational about the difficulty he had when he was breaking Ruth's record, and all these reporters kept saying to him, even as far back as June, do you think you can break Babe's record? And poor Roger's going, will you please leave me alone? Will you leave me alone? And by August, his hair was falling out. The pressure was so, so great. And he was telling, you know, the whole story. And so I was very, very fortunate with this book. And Dinchecko gave me another $2,500 to see the rest of the players. And the name of the book was Dynasty. And it came out in 1975. And it was the first of, you know, 10 bestsellers that I had. And the experience, though, is not anything that you ever forget. I mean, I love those people. I love them all. Every one of those players were so good to me and so kind to me and so wonderful. And then, of course, come January, while I'm doing this, January of 1973, Michael Burke sells the team to Steinbrenner and his buddies. And everything changed. Steinbrenner came in and literally fired everybody who was there. Steinbrenner had told everybody that he was going to stick to the boating business, you know, the shipping business, that he was not going to have any interference whatsoever in the Yankees, which, you know, Steinbrenner was so much like Trump, the guy could never tell the truth. Anyhow, my goodness, all of my friends were fired or quit, and it's just Marty Appel quit, they all quit. It was interesting to be there at the time.
I read Dynasty on my summer vacation.
Probably
about 1976.
I'll
be darned, yeah.
Yeah.
I did not make that connection. So.
But that is one of two times when I looked into the newspaper and I found something that changed my life.
Yeah.
The other time, I'm living in Ridgefield, Connecticut, and there's a little square notice in the middle of the sports page of USA Today. I don't know if you remember it, but it used to be an independent newspaper, and I would get it every once in a while. And it said, I am starting a league for retired Major League Baseball players in Florida. If any of you people, any of you players, want to join our league, here is the telephone number. And I thought to myself, what a fantastic idea for a book. So I called this fellow up. His name was Jim Morley. And I said, I would love to come down and, you know, see. He told me they were having a meeting of all the owners. He said, come down to the meeting of the owners and pick the team that you want to be with. So I did that. I flew down. The that was in Miami. Very special hotel. Anyhow, the team I picked was the West Palm Beach Tropics. Dick Williams was the manager. They had some great, interesting players. And I put down a $2,000 deposit on a house in Fisher Island. And that evening, I got a call from the PR guy. And the call said, we don't want you. You can't do this. You're not coming to our team. Well, I had written a book called Personal Fouls, which was about Jim Valvano. And the book had gotten Valvano fired. And this guy was Valvano's close friend. So I called up Jim Morley and I said, oh, what am I going to do? He said, well, I own the St. Pete Pelicans. Come and spend the season with the St. Pete Pelicans. I said, great. So I get in the car with my wife and two dogs, and down we come to St. Petersburg. And I have no idea where I'm going, and I'm riding down 275, and I see a sign, last exit until, you know, wherever. The bridge was coming. So I made a right at the Bayway, and I'm going over the top of that thing, and I see the Don Cesar Hotel. It's 75 degrees. The water is in the background. The sun is shining. I'm thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing living in Connecticut? So anyhow, so we park. The next day I go and visit the team. And Bobby Tolan's the manager, and Doc Ellis is the pitching coach. And Bobby Tolan says to me, I think we have a problem. I said, well, okay, what's the problem? He said, these ballplayers don't want you around. I said, well, will you give me a chance to talk to them and tell them what I am doing? He said, sure, why not? So, and this was down at Crescent Lake. You know where the ball field is down there? So I walk into the clubhouse.
This is the same field where the Yankees and the Mets.
Oh, the Yankees and the Mets and the, well, yeah. Baltimore and all those teams played games. Yes, 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 yes. Where Ruth hit the ball into the lake and the kid almost got eaten by an alligator. Yeah, that was the same place.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so Tolan says to me, you know, we got this problem. And so I said, can I talk to the players? And he goes, sure. Meanwhile, while I'm sitting there, Tolan's talking to me. Doc Ellis is walking around my chair and he's going, loser writer, loser writer, loser writer. He's teasing me. And so I go in front of this team of all these fabulous former Major League Baseball players and I tell them, the purpose of this book is to write about your love of the game of baseball. You are playing this again after you've retired because of how much you love the game. And I went on like that. And then I said to them, and by the way, if there's anything I write in this book that you don't like, you can read it and I'll take it out. And everybody goes, okay. And the meeting ends and nobody says in or out or anything like that. Everybody goes home. So I'm thinking to myself, where am I? What's the situation? But we were to get on the bus the next morning, go to Winter Haven, which I did, got on the bus with my briefcase and my tape recorder and so forth and so on. Nobody said a word, not one word. I spent three of the most marvelous, marvelous, marvelous months, three, 4 months, here in St. Petersburg. I had a house on the beach. It was just heaven. I mean, I was living in heaven. So immediately, and not only that, but we won the championship, by the way. You know, Steve Henderson was the most valuable player in the league. We had all these wonderful players. We won the championship. So I go home, sell the house, come back, rent this house that I'm living in right now. That was 1990. This is now 36 years later, and it's still heaven, yeah. Still. So those are all the stories I got. That's it.
All right. Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, I got to throw in a question here, so I feel like I'm interviewing. So you've written all these books all those years. Do you have a favorite book? Is the one that you're like, I'm really.
That's like asking if you have a favorite child. Come on. No. Do I have a favorite? You know, Dynasty was special because Dynasty was written in an age before computers. I mean, the funny thing is, Dynasty I wrote on a typewriter. You know, the thing was, 1,300 pages when I finished this thing. And my editor goes, we're not publishing 1,300 pages. And he cut the thing down to about 900 pages, which really sort of pissed off a few of the players because I had written about Gene Woodling in a wonderful way. And so Gene Woodling ended up being about two paragraphs instead of three pages. But he did a good job. Frank Coffey was the editor. He did a fine job. And the book came out, did well. And then I went to work for the Bergen Record as an editor. I was the assistant night news editor when I got a call from Billy Martin's business manager. How would you like to write a book with Billy? Well, was I going to say no? Well, hell yes, I'd like to write a book. But then, oddly enough, Billy was... I don't know, he had punched somebody out. Something had happened. And so the business manager had one other client, a guy by the name of Sparky Lyle. He said, why don't you come and do a book with Sparky? And I said, who cares about what Sparky has to say? He's a relief pitcher, for crying out loud. He goes, very smartly, because he was going to get a piece of this, very smartly, he said to me, come down to Florida, come down to Fort Lauderdale, and sit in the clubhouse with Sparky and see. And sure enough, I flew down there and got into the clubhouse, not only with Sparky, but Thurman Munson was there, and Reggie Jackson was there, and Greg Nettles was there, and Billy Martin was there, and Willie Randolph was there, and Lou Piniella was there. And I thought to myself, if Sparky would like to keep a diary of the 1978 season, this might be a pretty good book. And I lived in Englewood. And Sparky lived in two towns over. And so every day the Yankees were home, I would go over to his house and we would sit and talk for a couple hours. And he would let me know everything that was going on. And what I didn't realize was that Sparky was really angry with the Yankees, especially with Steinbrenner. He had been the Cy Young Award pitcher in 1977 as a relief pitcher. And after the season, Steinbrenner had signed. He was making $140,000 a year. Steinbrenner signed Goose Gossage for $2 million. And Sparky lost his job. So the Bronx Zoo, which is what it turned out to be, the name of the book, we sold 220,000 books because Sparky was very happy to tell everything that went on. I'd be sitting there listening, going with my hands on my cheeks, going, "Oh, really?" But wonderful stories. I mean, and funny stories too. They love to tease Munson. Thurman Munson was a guy, such a serious, grumpy guy. I saw Munson one time at an old timers' day. He was being interviewed by a guy who looked like the Kentucky Fried Chicken guy, with the white outfit. And while they were interviewing, Munson was spitting, chewing tobacco all over his pants. I'm thinking, who does that, But so one time, Munson, he had a gun and he needed a holster. So he applied for this holster with a .32 waist. So the players went and got the letter that he was sending to the company and changed 32 waist to 55 waist. So the thing comes back, and Thurman tries it on, and of course, it's way, 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 way too big. And Thurman is just furious. He's absolutely furious. So he changes the 55 waist to 32 waist, and the guys get it again and change it to a 12 waist and send the thing back out. And those are the sort of stories that Sparky was telling me, beside all of the things Steinbrenner was doing to the poor players. So, I mean, I do believe that The Bronx Zoo right now is probably the best-selling baseball book ever written.
You're listening to best-selling author Peter Gollenbach on Radio St. Pete. Why don't we just cancel the rest of the scheduled programming and just stay with us for the next 3 hours?
I think.
I know he's paying. go ahead.
Actually, speaking of Thurman, did you ever interview him? Did you find him? No.
I never interviewed Thurman. No, I had no need to.
I remember when I was a kid. It was back in 70 whatever. Munson came out. I was with my brother. We were waiting, trying to get some autographs.
Yeah, good
luck.
There's
a handful of people. The night was against a Washington senator. There was nobody in the stadium. And Thurman comes out, you know, charging. He's not going to talk. He's like, and everybody is screaming. And there was a young girl.
Okay.
And they're like, Thurman, you got to do the young girl. Come on, you got to sign her. And finally, he did stop. And then he trumped out. But yeah.
And they all hated Reggie Jackson. Every one of them hated Reggie Jackson, which was amazing. Yeah, Reggie's not a big fan of mine because every book I ever wrote talked about how terrible poor Reggie Jackson was.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Rays. You got all those notes here.
I got notes.
So
yes.
I know you're a big fan of the Rays. I love the Rays, too. And so are you looking forward to the season coming up?
Well, I'm looking forward to the season, except that they're leaving us.
Well, they already
crossed. Thank heaven I'm not 25 years old, because by the time they end up moving to Tampa, I'll be 98. So, I mean, that's all right. But I don't know. I feel betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
Every fan who lives in St. Petersburg feels betrayed. I mean, how could you not? You know, why would you not want to stay here? They had this fabulous deal that they were going to put together, and unfortunately this hurricane ripped this, you know, poor place apart,
mm-hmm.
and scuttled the deal. And I'm not positive that the Rays would have done it anyway, if you want to know the truth. Poor Stu Sternberg, you know, who's always complained about not having enough money, just sold the team for $1.7 billion. So I guess he can't complain about being poor anymore.
Yeah.
But anyhow.
Anyhow. So let me ask you this. We talk about they talk about the Rays way. You're with the team for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And then, boom, you're gone.
Yeah. The Rays way does everything except take into consideration how the fans feel about it. You know, they find fan favorites. Randy or Rosarena always comes to mind first,
mm-hmm.
because nobody was a fan favorite like Randy or Rosarena was. They had Randy Land on Fridays where they gave yellow shirts to all those fans, and they loved him. And for reasons to this day that I don't understand, maybe his walk to strikeout record isn't as great as it should have been, or maybe his WAR wasn't as high as
mm-hmm.
whatever that means, and I don't. They traded the guy away for players I have no idea even who they are. So Randy is starring for the Seattle Mariners, and he's not starring for us. And it's sad.
Yeah, I don't understand it. And you're right. It's the fans. It's hard to get an attachment to any of these players because it's almost in the back of your mind. It's like, well, why should I?
I have a bobblehead of a player. They were going to have a bobblehead night for this guy. I wish I could remember his name, but it doesn't matter. They traded him a week before bobblehead night. So I imagine there must be 15,000 bobbleheads of this guy in Africa somewhere. But I was able to get one. Brian Ault kindly gave me a bobblehead of Manny Ramirez.
Oh, wow.
Who was the greatest player ever to play for the Rays. Unfortunately, Manny, apparently he didn't want to be here. Because about 2 days into his being a Ray, he got somehow caught for some drug thing and suspended for the entire year, So I got my my bobblehead, which must be worth at least $20. But we didn't get to see Manny, because whenever Manny would come to the Trop playing for the Red Sox, always he would hit the ball over the frog pond or Rays pond. I've never seen anybody hit a ball so hard playing against us than Manny. He was such a superstar. Why he's not in the Hall of Fame right now is absolutely beyond me. He played for us for a week.
A week. You used to have season tickets. You got season tickets this year?
I have a membership.
I am
a member.
Really?
Yes. And I don't know if that's the Communist Party or whether that's the Rays. I don't know, but I'm a member. I am a member. So I have tickets right now to opening day. And as a result of getting tickets for opening day, they gave me free tickets to some other day. So I'm going on some other day. But soon as the season starts, I think last year, last year I went to 6 games because they were played in Tampa, and I'll be damned if I'm going to go to Tampa to watch the Rays play. But the year before that, I think of the 80 games, I probably went to 65 of them. I mean, there's nothing I love more than going to the Trop to watch the Rays play. I mean, it's just you're born with a gene, with the baseball gene, and it's like very much like going to church. It absolutely is, and there are at least 15 or 16,000 fans from St. Petersburg who believe as I do. Right. I can tell you that.
And I'm one.
There you go. It's something, the Trop. It's not the greatest.
It ballpark. Is the greatest.
Oh, okay.
Forget it. It is the greatest.
All right.
It's 72 degrees. It's beautiful. Wherever you sit, you got a great seat. I mean, I love watching the games at the Trop. You ever been to some of these other ball fields?
I've been to 43. What do you
think
of that?
Oh, my goodness. Where the ball players look to be about a half an inch tall.
Oh, it's terrible.
I agree with many of the other ballparks. The ball players, you can barely see them. You need, magnifying glasses to see them. Not at the Trop, though.
That's true. One thing I like about the Trop, and, you grew up a Yankee fan, and even
I
back
did.
Then, to get to Yankee Stadium or to get to see the Mets, it's a trip and a half.
Yeah, but you didn't mind.
To get
to see the Rays, I have to drive 3 miles.
That was exactly what I was going to say.
I know, it's rough.
And
3 miles are a tough one. I park in the church. Pay them the $6.
See?
Walk, have to walk all the way from the church to the Trop. It's tough.
When I drive, I know where I can park for free.
Ooh.
3 blocks away.
Probably alongside the church.
Could be.
But you get there really early. I don't get there that early.
There you go. So let's talk about Tony Curtis. Tell us about that. I'm just curious about that book and how did that happen? You're a sports guy. All of a sudden you're doing a Tony Curtis, and how was he to work with?
He was fantastic. We had such a fabulous time. I got a call from a literary agent. He wanted me to write a book about 3 rodeo cowboys. One was African-American, and he was a champion of the rodeo. And I wrote a proposal for it, and I really thought that we should have sold it. But like so many things, it's like writing about the Olympics. Trying to sell a book on the Olympics, forget it. Same with the rodeo cowboys. I mean, nobody, no publisher, Simon & Schuster, any of the others, wanted anything to do with the book on the rodeo cowboys. So I said to him, "Do you have any other clients?" He says, "Yes, I have one other client." I said, "Who's that?" He says, "Tony Curtis." I said, "How would Tony like to write a book?" He says, "I'll ask him." Now, we had a ball. He lived in Henderson, Nevada, right outside of Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, we would talk on the telephone. And a few times, I would go out to Henderson and spend a week with him. I stayed in one of those funky hotels. So I'd stay with him a couple hours, and then I'd go back to the hotel. And I'd take $10 and buy whatever you buy in order to play the slot machine. Because the question was, on my $10, how many hours could I stay and play that slot machine before I lost my $10? And that's what I would do the rest of the day. But he was... The other interesting thing about Tony, of course, is we got about 85% finished with the book, and I got a call back home. Tony is in a coma.
Tony's in a coma?
Yeah, Tony's in a coma. And he was in a coma for about 4 days. And I'm thinking, well, how in the world am I going to finish this book if he dies? But thank heaven he didn't die. He recovered. And we finished the book, and he said to me, you know, I have a bunch of stories that I wasn't going to tell you. But since I almost died, I'm going to tell you these stories. And he did, all about his mistresses.
Wow.
And they're all in the book. And he was just a prince. I call the book American Prince. That's who he was. And you know, stories about Marilyn Monroe and stories about all the different movies he made. He had a love of what he was doing. The only thing he didn't have a love of was children. So he was married to who was the gal who was stabbed to death in that movie, the Hitchcock movie?
The Psycho.
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 Okay.
Janet Leigh.
Go ahead.
Janet Leigh.
Janet Leigh was his first wife. So he was famous and Janet wasn't until she appeared in Psycho. And she was in this movie maybe a minute where they they stabbed her to death. And all of a sudden, she became more famous than he did. He didn't like that. The other thing was every time these wives would have children, of course the women wanted to spend more time with the children than they did with him. So every time they had children, he would divorce them and marry somebody else. I think when I was in Hendersonville, this was wife number five. Yeah. So that was an interesting aspect. Yeah. Interestingly enough, I was on the Cape Cod, where I walked into this antique shop, and it turned out the owner of the antique shop was wife number four, and she had read the book and she was not happy.
Oh boy!
Let's talk about a small world.
Oh my gosh! Yikes! I'm going to go back to the 1,300 pages or whatever it was for the first book.
Dynasty.
On a typewriter.
Yeah, on a typewriter.
What did you do when you made a mistake? Did you have whiteout?
Did you have that backspace? I didn't make
mistakes. I mean, that was my problem growing up.
I didn't make mistakes.
I could not write anything.
I didn't make mistakes.
No. Okay. All right. What have we got? A couple more minutes here?
Yeah, just a couple. This is working out because one of our guests has taken ill.
Oh no!
And so we're.
Oh no!
We're on time. Bill DeYoung will be in at 5. So
okay.
If you have any more
for my second book,
yes.
for the Bronx Zoo, I drove to Washington D.C. and I bought a Xerox 8000 word processor. This thing had nine inch discs. The thing cost me $4,000, if you can believe that. But the difference between doing it on a typewriter and doing it on a word processor was huge. I mean, I wish I had saved the thing. I don't know why. I mean, they kept getting newer and newer, and I kept throwing the old ones out. I should have kept my Xerox 8000. It would have been such a prize.
Well, that's what saved me, the word processors, because up to then, boy, I couldn't type. I mean, I could, but it was a disaster, just a disaster. Back to Tony Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any good stories about Marilyn Monroe that he told you or what?
He was dating her. He was dating her. She was difficult. She was very, very difficult. And some like it hot, the director of the film, after about a week, I mean, she show up late. She was a real pain in the neck. And they wanted to fire her. But then they looked at the rushes. And she was so magnetic. She was so spectacular. She was a very smart person. She was no dummy. That they decided, you know, whatever trouble she may cause, we're going to keep her in this movie. And they were right. I mean, she was stunning. Absolutely stunning in that movie. Tony was fabulous, too. It was, you know, one of the great comedy movies of all time.
So you did, entertainment-wise, you did Tony Curtis. Anybody else?
Entertainment-wise?
Yeah, non-baseball.
Non-baseball? Well, I did a book with the lawyer for the woman who supposedly killed Casey Anthony.
Oh. Now we're getting down to
yeah.
it.
Yeah. The book was called Presumed Guilty. And it was interesting. This lawyer, brilliant, brilliant man, you know, quickly proved that she didn't kill her daughter at all. Her daughter had, while she was sleeping, the daughter was being watched by the father, and the daughter had sort of escaped and had gone outside and then up the stairs to the swimming pool where she fell in and drowned. The father should have been watching, and he wasn't. And The book certainly proved that the father had been having sex with the mother, Casey's mother, since she was 9 years old. The father was a former policeman, so nobody was going after him. Mm-hmm. But he was a shady, shady character. But yeah, that was an exciting book to do too.
What about what are you working on now? You got something in the in the hopper here?
I have it in the hopper. Wonderful guy, Sandy Alderson, who was the general manager of the Oakland A's, the San Diego Padres, and the New York Mets. Sandy now lives here in St. Petersburg. He was the guy who actually invented Moneyball. It wasn't Billy Beane. Billy Beane was Sandy's protege. But Michael Lewis interviewed Billy Beane and wrote a book around Billy Beane and what Billy did. And that was the Moneyball book that became so successful it made him into a movie. And it always irked me because, you know, Sandy and I went to college together at Dartmouth. He's always a brilliant, brilliant guy. I just thought it would be nice to give Sandy his due. Mm. So we're going to do that. We're doing it right now.
Great. So you've interviewed, you know, hundreds of people. You've written about, you know, amazing people and places. Is there a book that, is there an interview you wished you could have done with somebody, like, who maybe is dead? Well, not maybe. Somebody is dead. Somebody long gone. Is there, if you had your druthers, boy, I wish I could, I don't know, I'm going to say Abraham Lincoln or something. Was there somebody that you really would have liked to have interviewed?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I was very fortunate because my Uncle Justin was Jackie Robinson's lawyer. You know, and had I not written Bums, my answer would have been Jackie Robinson. But because I wrote Bums, I was able to call Rachel Robinson up, and she said, of course, I will talk to you. And she talked to me because my uncle was her lawyer. And she talked to me for a good 2 hours, and her description of what she and Jackie had to go through as African Americans during the 40s and the 50s, oh, my goodness. And it's funny, she and I were born on the same day, July 19th. She's going to be 101 years old.
Wow.
But the answer to your question, except that I don't need to, would have been Jackie Robinson.
And so who were your favorite players growing up?
There was only Mickey? One. Yeah, Mickey Mantle. Mickey. Oh, of course.
Number seven.
Oh. I used to bat the way he batted. I switch hit the way he switch hit. I ran the way he ran. I didn't drink the way he drank. But I wrote a book called Seven, which is a novel. It's the book that I thought that Mickey would have written had he had the balls to do it. And unfortunately, the outcry when it came out was so great that the publisher decided to dump it in the lake. I still think it's one of the very best books written about Mantle. It's called Seven, the number seven. Hmm. And I still stand by it.
So you used to hit like Mantle or tried to hit like him. You're in a softball league now. Are you like the Mick? Are you a power hitter or what?
That's three. That's 3 minutes.
Yes.
You got three minutes.
Three minutes. Babe Ruth.
Three minutes.
Okay.
Just the way this interview has got 3 minutes to go, my softball career has got about 3 minutes to go. And in fact today, so that I could have played in my 31st year in the Half Century Softball League, I played the first two innings of the game, and I batted once. I grounded out because they put seven fielders around the infield because they knew I couldn't hit that far. But still, my one at bat, that's my 31st year in the Half Century Softball League, which is a record. Hopefully next year I'll play in my 32nd and I'll have an at bat. And I guess it's everybody's waving goodbye. So this is it. You're out of time.
Matt, is that it? All right. Well, wow. This has been a great, fun time. And everybody, remember, donate, right? This is what...
Oh, yeah. Donate. Yeah. Donate. Yeah. I forgot the donate part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Donate.
Not a donut. Donate.
No, donate. Yes. Right. Yes. And so, root for the Rays.
There you go. Root for the Rays. Dan Hirschberg.
Talk.
Oh, yes, May March 12th, I'll be at the St. Petersburg Museum talking about baseball, 6 o'clock, at, 6 to 8.
Yeah. Happy hour with the historian.
Happy hours, yeah. Okay. Well, I like happy hours. They're good, whether I'm talking about baseball or anything. Anyway, so if you like listening to me, check out DannyBaseball56 at yahoo.com. If you want to contact me, I got a Facebook page, DannyBaseball56. And, of course, look up Peter Golombek. He's got books, even if you know, you're not a baseball fan. Read his books. Come on, a guy needs to make a living here.
It was a great oral history today. This was outstanding, and I'm glad to... one of our guests took ill, so we could extend this.
But we're not saying anything. Yeah. We're not mentioning anything.
We'll see you guys on opening day, and hopefully
I'll be waving from 205.
Okay, I'm going to be in 104. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, terrific.
Whoa.
That was fun. This was the opposite of a dull, boring public radio fundraising day. So, so those of you who've been listening, if you'd enjoyed it, you can hear Peter on our St. Pete Sports Connection show quite often with Mike Rickard.
Absolutely.
And we hopefully will all be together on opening day on April 6th at Tropicana Field on the radio. So we'll work out those details. Well, this is Radio St. Pete Day in the city of St. Petersburg. Thanks to Dan Hirschberg, Peter Golombek. That was outstanding.